Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
I don't know if Pamela's been offered the job, and I don't know where she stands on the idea of becoming the White House Chief of Staff. But you would just be the latest person to probably turn that job down, Pamela,
yeah,
as more and more people whose names are associated with it say no thank you.
Only one thing is clear. John Kelly is on his way out as Chief of Staff. His replacement, though, entirely unclear. Over the past few weeks, the two have barely been on speaking terms. And the president didn't hide the fact he didn't always see eye to eye with his chief of staff. The president's top advisors expected Mike Pence's chief of staff, Nick Ayers, to replace Kelly. But over the weekend, Ayers took himself out of the running. Now the search is once again on.
It appears, and there was one of those standing on the lawn, headed to the helicopter conversations, and Trump also tweeting about it, that he had the succession plan and he was making this big announcement. Apparently he thought this other guy was taking the gig, Nick Ayers.
Yeah, it's supposed to be announced today.
Yeah, apparently that was a done deal up until the point that Nick Ayers said, oh, the hell I am. No, thank you. I'm leaving government at the end of the year, much less not becoming the White House chief of staff after being Vice President Pence's chief of staff. So who becomes the new chief of staff? Does it even matter in this White House? I don't know if it's a position. There are certain White Houses. I mean, here's why I say that. I just finished the movie Vice. We'll talk about it later, but about Dick Cheney and kind of his rise to power, right? And there are instances of White House chief of staffs who wielded power. You could be a real conduit. Who has access to the president? Who gets in? You know, what issues are brought up in front of him? You're a gatekeeper. Does anybody think that General John Kelly was a gatekeeper to that White House?
I think General John Kelly was brought to the Oval Office in order to restore some order. Because prior to him, you had Reince Priebus, who if you I know that this is like palace intrigue, so we'll get off it here in a second. But that like Reince Priebus allowed the door to be open at any moment. So everybody and everybody had access to the president. John Kelly came in to cut that down.
Shut the door.
So that they could get a little bit more control. It seems as though Kelly's a bit frustrated. The president is frustrated with him. So who that's going to be, we don't quite yet know. Some names, Whitaker, the guy that was the inner rim attorney general, might be moving over into that slot. A couple other names have been thrown out, but it was supposed to be named today. We'll see if by the end of the day we actually have one. But in the grand scheme of things, whoever is named chief of staff doesn't impact your life or my life one iota. What could, in some roundabout kind of way, have some sort of significance on the American people is what was dropped on Friday. And we're talking about some of the filings from the Robert Mueller special investigation.
Oh, okay.
Some 55 pages were dropped with some nuggets in relation to Michael Cohen, who is the former personal attorney to the president, and Paul Manafort, the former campaign manager for Trump back in 2016, because it was run up during the convention. Mm-hmm. Anywho, we learned a couple of things. Now, not a ton, but you got a lot of people out there that are reading the tea leaves. And by reading the tea leaves, we're left to understand that Michael Cohen directly points Donald Trump as the individual who told him to pay Stormy Daniels as well as the Playboy Playmates.
Ms. McDougal?
Now, if in fact that is true, that would be a campaign violation.
And it was done for the sole purpose of preventing bad news before an election.
Now, here's the other thing. That's not part of the special investigation.
No.
That's something that got kicked to the Southern District of New York. So what did we learn from the special prosecutor on Friday? Anything noteworthy, Bruce?
There are a couple things going on. Now, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to gloss over the fact that Michael Cohen implicated Trump in two felonies, campaign finance. I don't know a lot of people that believe that you either impeach or remove a president over campaign finance violations. In many cases, these are things that are dealt with fines. And I can acknowledge that, that high crimes and misdemeanors is campaign finance. And maybe it's because Mueller is not directly involved in this. It tells you he doesn't think it's that big a deal either. Michael Cohen, the president's attorney, fixer, whatever you want to call it, through some of these court filings, which is also part of this game where you kind of just put a little bit in there so that it's out there. This is Mueller leaking, for lack of better terms, that there are other people and other crimes or alleged crimes, because no one's been convicted of these yet, that may rise to a higher level. A conspiracy. This is the collusion. Where's the collusion? Yeah. A conspiracy to work with the Russian government to get information on a political party or candidate in order to help you win the election in return for something else. That is a crime in the United States. That is not opposition research. Working with a foreign government to do that is a crime, and people do go to jail for it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where this is headed?
Here's the thing. Nobody knows. And I think that that's important to point out.
Well, you say nobody knows, but there are parts of it that appear to be kind of known.
Yeah. That being said, though, these filings are important, but we're obscuring the continued uncertainty as to how much Mueller knows and what happens next. This is a case where he has kept those cards very, very close to the vest.
Absolutely.
And he has only shown a couple of them as he needs to take the investigation to the next step.
It appears, and again, you have to read through some of these court filings, and they're boring. I get it. In many cases, I have to rely on lawyers who understand what the hell that means. Is Cohen's got a bit of a scorched earth policy, where he's kind of, if I'm going down, I'm taking everybody with me attitude. And he's apparently going to jail for at least three and a half years, I think is what the sentencing argument was, guideline for him, was he's dragging former campaign manager Manafort and Trump into a conspiracy to work with the Russian government with something that is described as a synergy between an emissary of Putin's and an emissary of Trump's, be that Cohn or Manafort, that there was some sort of a discussion, meeting, transference of documents, etc. Remains to be seen. Got to prove it in court. Let's be honest. Got to prove it in court. And if it rose to that, would that change people's calculation? Because I just don't think campaign finance is going to be the thing.
I don't think it is either. But I think it could very well be one of the many straws that breaks the camel's back. It won't be the only one. If the Mueller team starts piling on other facts and other witnesses that can place individuals at an executive level within the Trump organization with ties to Russia and starts connecting those dots.
I don't know.
That's the big thing.
Right.
I don't think this is it.
Oh, I would agree.
I don't think that this is it.
And keep in mind, you know, when you look at Bill Clinton, which the last time a president was impeached, he was impeached, but he wasn't removed. He wasn't convicted by Congress. That is a pretty high bar. And again, I can acknowledge it should be a high bar.
It should be.
Removing a duly elected president from office should be a high bar. But the political calculation that goes on, let's be honest, inside the Republican Party, in the House and the Senate will be, if these allegations turn out to be true, if there is testimony, if there are convictions, if a jury decides, yes, this happened, if there are documents, recordings, God knows what, will they say it is in our political best interest to stand with Trump or against Trump? And that will be the calculation. It's a political process, impeachment. It operates a little outside of what the law is. Having said that.
That's like a but. Was that a but?
There,
did you just drop a but?
There is a legal argument out there that the office of the presidency provides you with certain protections.
Cover, yeah.
The minute you're a private citizen,
game changes.
You could be charged with all of these things, and the, but I used to be president, is not a defense against them. And so are they holding on to some of these things, saying, we'll wait until you can't pardon your way out of it. We'll wait until you're a private citizen. And then we'll go after people. And will that then, in a jury, in a trial, put people in jail? I haven't the foggiest idea. I admit that I don't know what Mueller has. But the idea that he has nothing, well, that's obviously not true by the number of people that are currently sitting in jail or have pled guilty. And we still don't know all of what they've told. And there's all these hints that some of them recorded conversations, possibly even wore a FBI wire.
But
to
we
meetings.
Don't know that. But again, we right. don't know that.
We will find out. We're going to find out one way or the other. It'll be interesting, my goodness, to say the least. Buckle up for 2019. I think that'll be a fair way to put it. We've all heard about bridezillas, but you know what? One of them might take the cake. We'll tell you about the dress code. Based on your BMI, for lack of better terms.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
I think it's fair to say, and Pamela, I get the sense that you looking at this story of this bridezilla, this could be one of these, we find out later, this is a bunch of hooey, they made it up, right?
Yes.
But if not, and listen, there is, if it's a made-up story, it's an elaborate one about a bride who is sending out instructions to the wedding party.
Yeah, and this is not atypical.
In advance yeah. of a wedding next year, a destination wedding in Hawaii.
Which you need a lot of directions for.
Ooh, okay.
Right? So I don't fault her for that whatsoever. Where things get a little odd is that, okay, so this is a dress code, not just for the bridal party, but for everybody in attendance at the wedding. And she says the dress code is going to be very specific because it'll be used to create an incredible visual effect. If done right, it'll make our synchronized dancing along the beach really pop.
Okay, right off the bat, I'm going to RSVP no.
She went on
for synchronized dancing on the beach
to go into great detail, breaking down said dress code, which requires different outfits for women between 100 and 160 pounds.
Wait a minute. It comes with a weight limit.
Yeah. Because
the synchronized dance routine is going to be segregated by weight.
In essence, if you are below 160, you have one outfit. If you are above 160, you have a different outfit.
Well, and the outfits in and of themselves tell you a little bit about what this bride thinks about you, because the thinner men and women are going to be brightly dressed, and I'm going to assume are going to be up front in this synchronized dance routine on the beach. The heavier amongst us are going to be dressed in black or camouflage and are going to be stuck in the back.
Okay, does camo really work on a beach?
You have to dress sand color. Because if you're wearing camo on a beach, you would say, look at that guy wearing camo on the beach, not I can't see him.
The crazy directions by this bridezilla made their way onto Reddit, and nobody ever wants to be on Reddit.
No good comes of that.
Which then led to bridezilla saying, hey, everyone, want to let you know you're being invited to the first ever polygraph party at my house. Yeah. She is so ticked off that someone shared this that she says they bought a polygraph test. They're going to be having a party. You are expected to be there. If not, you are presumed guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you are innocent, you have nothing to worry about. This cannot be true. This cannot be. Who does this?
Yeah, she's mad that she has a snitch in her wedding party who apparently thought it was inappropriate to not only dress people but choreograph them based on weight. And she wants to get to the bottom of this. I don't know. When I read how these are written, when I read these Facebook posts and the ones that have been posted on Reddit, this strikes me as a bridezilla.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This strikes me as so outrageous and outlandish. Like, I keep asking the question, who are these people? Who thinks that this is okay? I get the whole idea of this is my special day and I want it to be a particular way. But that's within, like, where's the venue and what kind of cake are you going to have and how many guests are you – like, all that is reasonable to me.
The
this
problem
is so it has, outlandish.
It has such unique – details to it. For example, The expensive clothing represents the riches we wish to come. The black and camouflage outfits represent the aura of the devil that we must shoo away. So right off the bat, she's acknowledging that you fat people are the devil. Secondly, the soda hats represent our wishes for an abundance of life-saving liquid. You get the picture. We met at a psychic desensitization chamber 12 years ago in Italy, as you all know. Why not bring our traditions and beliefs into our wedding? Anyway, I'm tired of having to explain myself over and over again. Please keep me updated. That is,
okay,
for
is
those
weird.
Of you that are willing to come to the Sherlock Holmes party and
polygraph
be
party.
Polygraphed to find out if
okay,
you're the...
Here's why I call shenanigans. Okay, yeah. So after the whole, like, hey, you know, come to the said polygraph party, and if you're innocent, you got nothing to worry about. She says, I highly suggest whoever did this just tell me. I won't retaliate. I will simply cut ties and communication with you and talk crap about you for a long, long time. If you have any information about who violated my trust in my wedding planning, I will give you $100. She went on to attempt to present a reasonable front, telling anyone who has a problem with the dress code and spending about a grand on your outfit to come talk to her. This is where the spidey senses,
beyond everything else, really
start tingling.
Here we go.
Rather than participating in the dance, she said, they can help with the cleaning crew after dinner, take videos of the dance, or contribute to the honeymoon. If you don't want to drop a grand on orange suede pants,
dear God, or what
a
was
green
it, the blue fuzzy jacket for the guys,
purple
me, fuzzy,
a green velvet sweater, Louis Vuitton shoes,
and I'm going to take your word that those are expensive because I
super
can't even pronounce
expensive.
That word. Okay,
and
I always thought they were saying Louis Vuitton. By the way.
Yeah, I might be mispronouncing. I know it's not Louis Vuitton.
No. But I know. I think it's called Louboutin. It's a B as in boy, right?
Yeah.
Louboutin. But I always thought they were saying Louis Vuitton.
No.
That's how bad I am.
I just know they have the red soles.
Okay.
And they're super duper expensive.
I'm going to take
and uncomfortable from what I've been
told. I thankfully haven't been tricked into buying any of these yet.
Yet. Good night.
Wow. The dress code is very specific. It'll be used to create an incredible visual effect. If done right, it will make our synchronized dancing along the beach really pop.
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
I get that. I wouldn't be attending that wedding in a month of Sundays.
That's where the relationship ends. I don't need people like that in my life.
Agreed. Screen time. How does it affect kids, specifically their minds when they're developing? There's new information out there from scientists that don't paint a nice picture. We'll tell you about it coming up next.
Arizona's news station, KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
So what is the impact that screen time has on kids? And when we say kids, that can be a wide range, right?
Yeah.
There is new information out there. Researchers have been taking a look at just how screen time, a phone, a tablet, a TV affects developing brains.
And we're starting to get some information, the latest coming from the National Institute of Health, who has been involved in this $300 million research project that's going to be taking some 4,500 kids and studying their brains, scanning their brains over an extended period of time. Now, they've already been doing this for a little while, but they don't have a ton of data yet. Enough, though, that they felt it was necessary to get this information out to people. Parents in particular, who have concerns about the amount of time their kids are spending in front of a screen because they know it just doesn't feel right. It might be easy, but it just doesn't feel right. What is it doing to our children? Well, I know this is on the high end, but when you're adding cell phones, with iPads, with laptops, with televisions, with computer screens at school, screen time just in general, kids who spend 7 hours or more, smartphones, tablets, it's starting to thin the brain cortex.
What?
Yeah, take a listen to this.
That's typically thought to be a maturational process. So what we would expect to see later is happening a little bit earlier.
Should parents be concerned by that?
We don't know if it's being caused by the screen time. We don't know yet if it's a bad thing. It won't be until we follow them over time that we will see if there are outcomes that are associated with the differences that we're seeing in this single snapshot.
So maybe the frustrating or the scary part maybe for parents is we don't know the full effects until we have maybe another decade or so of data behind it.
Sure, but you're starting to see some correlation, maybe not causation, but you're starting to see some correlation.
In many ways, the concern that investigators like I have is that we're sort of in the midst of a natural kind of uncontrolled experiment on the next generation of children.
I mean, you want your kid to be a guinea pig is really what this is getting out to be.
Wow.
And you've got the researchers, not just the doctors who are taking a look at this, but the researchers. There's a guy from Google, one of their researchers, who was one of the first to come out and say, parents, you got to be aware of this. This is something that is not like it was when you were growing up. There are some major differences you need to understand.
Yeah. Do you think parents understand the complexities of what their kids are dealing with?
No, and I think this is really important because there's a narrative that, oh, I guess they're just doing this like we used to gossip on the phone. But what this misses is that your telephone in the 1970s didn't have 1,000 engineers on the other side of the telephone who were redesigning it to work with other telephones and then updating the way your telephone worked every day to be more and more persuasive.
More and more persuasive, more and more addictive. Now, he didn't use the word addictive. I will.
Okay.
At the end of this research, they're going to be able to tell if, in fact, this technology is addictive.
There's a whole playbook of techniques that get used to get you using for the product for as long as possible.
Harris is a former Google manager who was one of the first Silicon Valley insiders to publicly acknowledge that phones and apps are being designed to capture and keep kids' attention.
This is about the war for attention and where that's taking society and where that's taking technology.
And where that's taking our kids.
I there is something to be said for that. And it's not a secret that app developers, tech companies are in the business of getting you to download their app, and then they call it stickiness, how much time you spend with it. So that's not like, oh my God.
But
the problem is if they're doing it with 2-year-olds.
But I mean, that's the thing. Do people realize that these app developers, they have psychologists, they have sociologists, they have behavioral experts on the payroll to make this as addictive as possible? And when you talk about the kids, the babies, that's really where you got to pay some attention.
If you're concerned about your teenager being addicted to their iPhone, your infant is much more vulnerable and using the exact same device. Because the experience of making something happen is so much more gratifying to them.
When they get that reward.
Well, you're training them like Pavlov's dogs. You're training babies and infants that you do something, you get a reward, with the converse of that being the minute you take that thing away from them and they don't get their reward, do you get a screaming baby?
This is a 60 Minutes piece that aired yesterday, and I want to encourage parents to go back and watch it. In it, Bruce, they gave, let's say, like a 2-year-old, an 18-month to 2-year-old, they give them a regular toy, right, where they get to pound on it and make music, okay?
Yes.
Then they ask to have the toy back,
okay.
And the kid goes, okay.
Yeah, right.
And most of them gave the toy back.
Sharing is caring.
Gave them a tablet with like Bubble Guppies or something on it,
okay.
TV show or an app that there's
no
reward.
They got to engage with. Oh, okay.
But there's no reward.
Right.
And they asked for the tablet back, and the kid would give the tablet back.
No problem.
Now they had an app where if they touched certain colors or if they did certain things, lights would go
something
off, music
happened.
Would happen, and there was a reward
there
for
was
it.
An engagement, and they were getting rewarding for doing something on the
and
app.
They asked for the tablet, and they wouldn't give it back.
They're saying no, not giving that one back, keeping this one forever.
We asked you on the open mic line, 602-200-2733, your thoughts on this. Does it change the way you think about your kids having technology? Heck, does it change the way you think about having technology? Here's what you're saying across the valley.
My name is Jen. I'm from Scottsdale. I have a 4-year-old and a 19-month-old. The 4-year-old, I started screen time really young, and he is on his iPad for quiet time, maybe 1 to 2 hours in the afternoon. And
wow.
I'm definitely going to change that after hearing the statistics on the 60 Minutes. And my younger one, I have not introduced any screen time to, and I don't plan on doing that for quite some time.
Hey, listen, Mom, I get it. I've been there myself, where you just want to clean the kitchen or you just want to sit down and breathe because you've got 2 little ones at home. That is so hard to come by. And if this is what can get you a few minutes to breathe, I absolutely get it. And I'm not chastising anyone. I'm simply just saying, be aware and make that the exception and not the norm.
I think the it would be interesting to hear back from that mom about how difficult it is to wean the four-year-old off of screen time. Because as we're hearing, if they're engaged in these things where they get some reward for their screen time, shutting that iPad off or taking away from them can be a challenge.
Yeah, but you can handle that challenge when they're four. It's going to be a lot harder when they're 14.
Fair enough. Might be one of the reasons why you need to have your faith in humanity restored. Pamela says she can do that for us coming up next.
Arizona's news station, KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
I want to start this, and I mentioned to you off the air, Pamela, I want to mention something because it plays into kind of needing to have our faith in humanity restored. Some of you may be familiar with the term Ryan's House here in the Valley. It is a place for families with kids who have serious, life-threatening, and in some cases, unrecoverable illnesses and diseases as they navigate through this. It is unique here. It's tied in with some of the children's hospitals around here, and they do amazing work. Ryan, the young man who I met, passed away over the weekend. Ryan of Ryan's House passed away. His mom announced it on Facebook. And a 17-year-old boy who, 2004, they started Ryan's House when they had the need because of his unique medical challenges and the amount of lives that they've touched in the meantime and the goodness they've brought to the world and the legacy and honoring their son the way they do with the work that Ryan House will continue to do. But I'm sorry to be the one to have to tell people. I think a lot of people know about Ryan House and understand the great work they do, and just a sad time for the Cotter family.
Yeah, you know, and we talk about losing loved ones, and that's a little bit about what the faith in humanity is today. But there's a very positive note that we'll end on here. I got to take you guys back to January 8th, 2011.
Why would I know
and
that?
And you would know that because of this, Bruce.
A shooting at the Safeway. A man with a semi-automatic weapon unit just responding advice. We have a caller who believes that Gabrielle Giffords was shot. Multiple victims. Sounds like many people are shot.
It was a Saturday morning.
January 8th, 2011. I remember exactly where I was when I got the call that come into the station and head on down to Tucson. I and some of our colleagues here at the station spent several days down in Tucson. And I distinctly remember as we were wrapping up our coverage, I want to say it was like Sunday, the Sunday's coverage, Pat McMahon had asked me, in 5 years, 5 years from now, what about this are you going to remember most?
Mm. Okay.
And I remember telling him, Christina Taylor Green. This was the young lady. And by young, I mean eight.
Yeah, I was going to say really young, elementary age.
Who was shot and killed in that Safeway parking lot in Tucson.
Yep.
And I remember going to the school where all of her classmates had covered the fence. And, you know, me now having a nine-year-old myself, it strikes home. But this little girl is still surprising her parents today. Mom and Dad got a voicemail recently. They actually had to listen to it twice because it was the Hall of Fame award-winning baseball writer, Peter Gammons. And he was going to be inducted into the Cape Cod Baseball League's Hall of Fame. An award that is going to be named after him was called the Peter Gammons Award for excellence.
Legendary baseball writer Peter Gammons, who's now a Hall of Famer, just had an award created by the Cape Cod League named after him. Well, Christina will be posthumously be awarded this first ever Peter Gammons Award for excellence and distinction.
So mom and dad were like, okay, we didn't even know that she had met Peter Gammons. Now, the family would go to like the Boston area, Cape Cod in particular, every summer because dad was a scout for the LA Dodgers.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
You remember this
coming
is all
back
coming
now.
Back
yes,
to you now,
yes.
right?
Because it affected the Dodger organization. I remember that.
As dad would go to work, Christina Taylor and her brother would go to baseball camps.
Okay.
She was an 8-year-old girl attending baseball camp, which was somewhat of a rare sight. Okay.
I'll acknowledge that.
And she struck up a conversation with Peter Gammons, who lives in the area. And he recalls her telling him she's going to be the first woman to play in the major leagues.
Got it.
She told him, I got mad skills. And went on to say that she's also going to be the first woman president.
Wow.
Obviously, he was touched by her. And as the first recipient, he named her.
She just really got along with the people in Massachusetts and the Boston area. And she loved the sea and just the community feel of Cape Cod. So I know that she's smiling down for heaven and really proud that we're going to receive this award in her honor.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
Well, I was going to say, frustratingly, sadly, a name that we don't think about every day, but we should, you know, we should remember. We're coming up on the anniversary of that again.
The nomination read, "We are better people thanks to the passion and vision of this young lady who had no idea how many lives she was touching at the time."
Wow.
The family was back there and they accepted the award on her behalf on December 1st.
Thank you very much, Pamela. Restoring faith in humanity. Sincerely appreciate that. And hey, we look through the glass over there. We've got DJ Tommy Two-Tone. We've got super producer Stevie Z. And I want to say Sharon Middleman's going to stick around, right? Why not?